Chapter 24 of the Tyranny of Eugenius, and the Victory Won Through Faith by the Emperor Theodosius. In this manner the peace of the churches was secured by the most religious emperor. Before the establishment of peace he had heard of the death of Valentinianus, and of the usurpation of Eugenius, and had marched for Europe. 1. At this time there lived in Egypt, 2. a man of the name of John, who had embraced the ascetic life. Being full of spiritual grace, he foretold many future events to persons, who from time to time came to consult him. To him the Christ-loving emperor sent, in his anxiety, to know whether he ought to make war against the tyrants. In the case of the former war he foretold a bloodless victory. In that of the second he predicted that the emperor would only win after a great slaughter. With this expectation the emperor set out, and, while drawing up his forces, shot down many of his opponents, but lost many of his barbarian allies. 3. When his generals represented that the forces on their side were few, and recommended him to allow some pause in the campaign, so as to muster an army at the beginning of spring, and outnumber the enemy, Theodosius refused to listen to their advice. "For it is wrong," said he, "to charge the cross of salvation with such infirmity, for it is the cross which leads our troops, and attributes such power to the image of Hercules which is at the head of the forces of our foe." Thus in right faith he spoke, though the men left him were few in number, and much discouraged. Then when he had found a little oratory, on the top of the hill, where his camp was pitched, he spent the whole night in prayer to the God of all. About cockcrow sleep overcame him, and, as he lay upon the ground he thought he saw two men in white raiment riding upon white horses, who bade him be of good cheer, drive away his fear, and at dawn arm, and marshal his men for battle. "For," said they, "we have been sent to fight for you." And one said, "I am John the Evangelist," and the other, "I am Philip the Apostle." After he had seen this vision the emperor ceased not his supplication, but pursued it with still greater eagerness. The vision was also seen by a soldier in the ranks, who reported it to his centurion. The centurion brought him to the tribune, and the tribune to the general. The general supposed that he was relating something new, and reported the story to the emperor. Then said Theodosius, "Not for my sake has this vision been seen by this man, for I have put my trust in them that promised me the victory. But that none may have supposed me to have invented this vision, the cause of my eagerness for the battle, the protector of my empire has given the information to this man too, that he may bear witness to the truth of what I say when I tell you that first to me did our Lord vouchsafe this vision. Let us then fling aside our fear, let us follow our front rank, and our generals. Let none weigh the chance of victory by the number of the men engaged, but let every man bethink him of the power of the leaders." He spoke in similar terms to his men, and after thus inspiring all his host with high hope, led them down from the crest of the hill. The tyrant saw the army coming to attack him from a distance, and then armed his forces, and drew them up for battle. He himself remained on some elevated ground, and said that the emperor was desirous of death, and was coming into battle, because he wished to be released from this present life, so he ordered his generals to bring him alive and in chains. When the forces were drawn up in battle array those of the enemy appeared by far the more numerous, and the tale of the emperor's troops might be easily told. But when both sides had begun to discharge their weapons the front rank proved their promise as true. A violent wind blew right in the faces of the foe, and diverted their arrows and javelins and spears, so that no missile was of any use to them, and neither trooper nor archer nor spearman was able to inflict any damage upon the emperor's army. Vast clouds of dust, too, were carried into their faces, compelling them to shut their eyes, and protect them from attack. The imperial forces, on the other hand, did not receive the slightest injury from the storm, and vigorously attacked and slew the foe. The vanquished then recognized the divine help given to their conquerors, flung away their arms, and begged the emperor for quarter. Theodosius then yielded to their entreaty, and had compassion on them, and ordered them to bring the tyrant immediately before him. Eugenius was ignorant of how the day had gone, and when he saw his men running up the hillock where he sat, all out of breath, and showing their eagerness by their panting, he took them for messengers of victory, and asked if they had brought Theodosius in chains, as he had ordered. "No," said they, "we are not bringing him to you, but we are come to carry you off to him, for so the great ruler has ordained." Even as they spoke they lifted him from his chariot, put chains upon him, and carried him thus lettered, and led away the vain boaster of a short hour ago, now a prisoner of war. The emperor reminded him of the wrongs he had done Valentinianus, of his usurped authority, and of the wars which he had waged against the rightful emperor. He ridiculed also the figure of Hercules, and the foolish confidence it had inspired, and at last pronounced the sentence of right and lawful punishment. Such was Theodosius in peace, and in war, ever asking, and never refused the help of God. 1. Chapter 25 of the Death of the Emperor Theodosius. 1. After this victory Theodosius fell sick and divided his empire between his sons, assigning to the elder the sovereignty which he had wielded himself, and to the younger the throne of Europe. 2. He charged both to hold fast to the true religion, for by its means, said he, peace is preserved, war is stopped, foes are rooted, trophies are set up and victory is proclaimed. After giving this charge to his sons he died, leaving behind him imperishable fame. His successors in the empire were also inheritors of his piety. Chapter 26 of Honorius the Emperor and Telemachus the Monk. Honorius, who inherited the empire of Europe, put a stop to the gladiatorial combats which had long been held at Rome. The occasion of his doing so arose from the following circumstance. A certain man of the name of Telemachus had embraced the ascetic life. He had set out from the east and for this reason had repaired to Rome. There, when the abominable spectacle was being exhibited, he went himself into the stadium, and, stepping down into the arena, endeavored to stop the men who were wielding their weapons against one another. The spectators of the slaughter were indignant, and inspired by the triad fury of the demon, who delights in those bloody deeds, stoned the peacemaker to death. When the admirable emperor was informed of this he numbered Telemachus in the array of victorious martyrs, and put an end to that impious spectacle. Chapter 27 of the Piety of the Emperor Arcadius, and the Ordination of John Chrysostom. On the death at Constantinople of Nectarius, bishop of that see, Arcadius, who had succeeded to the Eastern Empire, summoned John, the great luminary of the world. He had heard that he was numbered in the ranks of the presbyterate, and now issued orders to the assembled bishops to confer on him divine grace, and appoint him shepherd of that mighty city. 1. This fact is alone sufficient to show the emperor's care for divine things. At the same time the see of Antioch was held by Flavianus, and that of Laodicea by Elpidius, who had formerly been the comrade of the great Meletius, and had received the impress of his life and conversation more plainly than wax takes the impression of a seal ring. 2. He succeeded the great Pelagius, 3, and the divine Marcellus, 4, was followed by the illustrious Agapetus, 5, whom I have already described as conspicuous for high ascetic virtue. In the time of the tempest of heresy, of Silencia and Dorum, Maximus, 6, the companion of the great John, was bishop, and of Mosuestia Theodorus, 7, both illustrious teachers, conspicuous, 2, in wisdom and character was the holy Acacius, 8, bishop of Berea, Leontius, 9, a shining example of many virtues, tended the flock of the Galatians. Chapter 28, of John's boldness for God. When the great John had received the tiller of the church, he boldly convicted certain wrongdoers, made seasonable exhortations to the emperor and empress, and admonished the clergy to live according to the laws laid down. Transgressors against these laws he forbade to approach the churches, urging that they who showed no desire to live the life of true priests ought not to enjoy priestly honor. He acted with this care for the church not only in Constantinople, but throughout the whole of Thrace, which is divided into 6 provinces, and likewise of Asia, which is governed by 11 governors. Ponticato, which has a like number of rulers with Asia, was happily brought by him under the same discipline. 1. Chapter 29 of the idol temples which were destroyed by John in Phoenicia. On receiving information that Phoenicia was still suffering from the madness of the demon's rites, John got together certain monks, who were fired with divine zeal, armed them with imperial edicts, and dispatched them against the idol's shrines. The money which was required to pay the craftsmen and their assistants, who were engaged in the work of destruction, was not taken by John from imperial resources, but he persuaded certain wealthy and faithful women to make liberal contributions, pointing out to them how great would be the blessing their generosity would win. Thus the remaining shrines of the demons were utterly destroyed, too. Chapter 30 of the Church of the Goths. It was perceived by John that the Scythians were involved in the Arian net. He therefore devised counter-contrivances, and discovered a means of winning them over, appointing presbyters and deacons and readers of the divine oracles, who spoke the Scythian tongue. He assigned a church to them, one, and by their means won many from their error. He used frequently himself to visit it, and preach there, using an interpreter, who was skilled in both languages, and he got other good speakers to do the same. This was his constant practice in the city, and many of those who had been deceived he rescued by pointing out to them the truth of the apostolic preaching. Chapter 31 of his care for the Scythians, and his zeal against the Martianists. On learning that some of the nomads encamped along the Danube were thirsty for salvation, but had none to bring them the stream, John sought out men who were filled with the love of labor, like that which had distinguished the apostles, and gave them charge of the work. I have myself seen a letter written by him to Leontius, bishop of Ancyra, in which he described the conversion of the Scythians, and begged that fit men for their instruction might be sent. On hearing that in our district, too, some men were infected with the plague of Martian, he wrote to the then bishop charging him to drive out the plague, and proffering him the aid of the imperial edicts. I have said enough to show how, to use the words of the divine apostle, he carried in his heart the care of all the churches three. His boldness may also be learned from other sources. Chapter 32 of the demand made by Gainas, and of John Chrysostom's reply. One Gainas, a Scythian, but still more barbarous in character, and of cruel and violent disposition, was at that time a military commander. He had under him many of his own fellow countrymen, and with them commanded the Roman cavalry and infantry. He was an object of terror not only to all the rest, but even to the emperor himself, who suspected him of aiming at usurpation. He was a participator in the Arian pest, and requested the emperor to grant him the use of one of the churches. Arcadius replied that he would see to it, and have it done. He then sent for the divine John, told him of the request that had been made, reminded him of the power of Gainas, hinted at the usurpation which was being aimed at, and besought him to bridle the anger of the barbarian by this concession. 1. But, said that nobleman, attempt, sir, no such promise, nor order what is holy to be given to the dogs. 2. I will never suffer the worshippers and praisers of the divine word to be expelled, and their church to be given to them that blaspheme him. Have no fear, sir, of that barbarian. Call us both, me and him, before you. Listen in silence to what is said, and I will both curb his tongue and persuade him not to ask what it is wrong to grant. The emperor was delighted with what Chrysostom said, and on the next day summoned both the bishop and the general before him. Gainas began to request the fulfillment of the promise, but the great John said in reply that the emperor, who professed the true religion, had no right to venture on any act against it. Gainas rejoined that he also must have a place to pray in. Why, said the great John, every church is open to you, and nobody prevents you from praying there when you are so disposed. But I, said Gainas, belong to another sect, and I ask to have one church with them. And surely I, who undergo so many toils in war for Romans, may fairly make such a request. But, said the bishop, you have greater rewards for your labors. You are a general, you are vested in the consular robe, and you must consider what you were formerly, and what you are now, your indigence in the past, and your present prosperity, what kind of raiment you wore before you crossed the Ister, and what you are robed in now. Consider, I say, the littleness of your labors, and the greatness of your rewards, and be not unthankful to them who have shewn you honor." With these words the teacher of the world silenced Gainas, and compelled him to stand dumb. In process of time, however, he made known the rebellion which he had long had at heart, gathered his forces in Thrace, and went out ravaging and plundering in very many directions. At news of this there arose an universal panic among both princes and subjects, and no one was found willing to march against him, no one thought it safe to approach him with an embassage, for every one suspected his barbarous character. Chapter 33, of the Embassage of Chrysostom to Gainas. Then when everyone else was passed over because of the universal panic, this great chief was persuaded to undertake the embassage. He took no heed of the dispute which has been related, nor of the ill-feeling which it had engendered, and readily set out for Thrace. No sooner did Gainas hear of the arrival of the envoy, than he bethought him of the bold utterance which he had made on behalf of true religion. He came eagerly froth a great distance, to meet him, placed his right hand upon his eyes, and brought his children to his saintly knees. So is it the nature of goodness to put even those who are most opposed to it to the blush, and vanquish them. But envy could not endure the bright rays of his philosophy. It put in practice its wonted wiles, and deprived of his eloquence, and his wisdom the imperial city, aye indeed the whole world, one. Chapter 34, of the events which happened on account of Chrysostom. At this part of my history I know not what sentiments to entertain, wishful as I am to relate the wrong inflicted on Chrysostom. I yet regard in other respects the high character of those who wronged him. I shall therefore do my best to conceal even their names. Two, these persons had different reasons for their hostility, and were unwilling to contemplate his brilliant virtue. They found certain wretches who accused him, and, perceiving the openness of the calumny, held a meeting at a distance from the city, and pronounced their sentence. 3. The emperor, who had confidence in the clergy, ordered him to be banished. So Chrysostom, without having heard the charges brought against him, or brought forward his defense, was forced as though convicted on the accusations advanced against him to quit Constantinople. 1. And departed to Hieron, at the mouth of the Euxine, for so the naval station is named. In the night there was a great earthquake, and the empress, too, was struck with terror. Envoys were accordingly sent at daybreak to the banished bishop, beseeching him to return without delay to Constantinople, and avert the peril from the town. After these another party was sent, and yet again others. After them and the Bosphorus was crowded with the couriers. When the faithful people learned what was going on, they covered the mouth of the Propontis with their boats, and the whole population lighted up waxen torches, and came forth to meet him. For the time indeed his banded foes were scattered. 3. But after the interval of a few months they endeavored to enact punishment, not for the forged indictment, but for his taking part in divine service. After his deposition, the bishop represented that he had not pleaded, that he had not heard the indictment, that he had made no defense, that he had been condemned in his absence, that he had been exiled by the emperor, and by the emperor again recalled. Then another synod met, and his opponents did not ask for a trial, but persuaded the emperor that the sentence was lawful and right. Chrysostom was then not merely banished, but relegated to a petty and lonely town in Armenia, of the name of Cucusus. Even from thence he was removed and deported to Pityus, a place at the extremity of the Euxine, and on the marches of the Roman Empire, in the near neighborhood of the wildest savages. But the loving Lord did not suffer the victorious athlete to be carried off to this islet, for when he had reached Comana he was removed to the life that knows nor age nor pain. 4. The body that had struggled so bravely was buried by the side of the coffin of the martyred Basiliscus, for so the martyr had ordained in a dream. I think it needless to prolong my narrative by relating how many bishops were expelled from the church on Chrysostom's account, and sent to live in the ends of the earth, or how many ascetic philosophers were involved in the same calamities, and all the more because I think it needful to curtail these hideous details, and to throw a veil over the ill deeds of men of the same faith as our own. Punishment, however, befall on most of the guilty, and their sufferings were a means of good to the rest. This great wrong was regarded with special detestation by the bishops of Europe, who separated themselves from communion with the guilty parties. In this action they were joined by all the bishops of Illyria. In the east most of the cities shrank from participation in the wrong, but did not make a rent in the body of the church. On the death of the great teacher of the great teacher of the world, the bishops of the west refused to embrace the communion of the bishops of Egypt, of the east, of the Bosphorus, and in Thrace, until the name of that holy man had been inserted among those of deceased bishops. Arsacius, his immediate successor, they declined to acknowledge, but Atticus, the successor of Arsacius, after he had frequently solicited the boon of peace, was after a time received when he had inserted the name in the roll. 1. Chapter 35 of Alexander, Bishop of Antioch. At this time the See of Alexandria was held by Cyril, 2, brother's son to Theophilus, whom he succeeded. At the same time Jerusalem was occupied by John, 1, in succession to Cyril, whom we have formerly mentioned. The Antiochian were under the care of Alexander, 2, whose life and conversation were of a piece with his episcopate. Before his consecration he passed his time in ascetic training, and in hard bodily exercise. He was known as a noble champion, teaching by word, and confirming the word by deed. His predecessor was Porphyrius, who guided that church after Flavianus, and left behind him many memorials of his loving character. 3. He was also distinguished by intellectual power. The holy Alexander was special urge in self-discipline and philosophy. His life was one of poverty and self-denial. His eloquence was copious and his other gifts were innumerable. By his advice and exhortation, the following of the great Eustathius, which Paulinus, and after him Evagrius, had not permitted to be restored, was united to the rest of the body, and a festival was celebrated the like of which none had ever seen before. The bishop gathered all the faithful together, both clergy and laity, and marched with them to the assembly. The procession was accompanied by musicians. One hymn was sung by all in harmony, and thus he and his company went in procession from the western postern to the great church, filling the whole forum with people, and constituting a stream of thinking living beings, like the Orontes, in its course. When this was seen by the Jews, by the victims of the Arian plague, and by the insignificant remnant of pagans, they set up a groaning and wailing, and were distressed at seeing the rest of the rivers discharging their waters into the church. By Alexander the name of the great John was first inscribed in the records, 4, of the church. Chapter 36, of the removal of the remains of John, and of the faith of Theodosius, and his sisters. At a later time the actual remains of the great doctor were conveyed to the imperial city, and once again the faithful crowd turning the sea, as it were into land by their close-packed boats, covered the mouth of the Bosphorus, towards the Propontis, with their torches. The precious possession was brought into Constantinople, by the present emperor, 1, who received the name of his grandfather, and preserved his piety undefiled. After first gazing upon the bier he laid his head against it, and prayed for his parents, and for pardon on them, who had ignorantly sinned, for his parents had long ago been dead, leaving him an orphan in extreme youth, but the God, of his fathers, and of his forefathers permitted him not to suffer trial from his orphanhood, but provided for his nurture in piety, protected his empire from the assaults of sedition, and bridled rebellious hearts. Ever mindful of these blessings he honors his benefactor with hymns of praise. Associated with him in this divine worship are his sisters, 2, who have maintained virginity throughout their lives, thinking the study of the divine oracles, 3, the greatest delight, and reckoning that riches beyond robbers' reach are to be found in ministering to the poor. The emperor himself was adorned by many graces, and not least by his kindness and clemency, an unruffled calm of soul, and a faith as undefiled as it is notorious. Of this I will give an undeniable proof. A certain ascetic somewhat rough of temper came to the emperor with a petition. He came several times without attaining his object, and at last excommunicated the emperor, and left him under his ban. The faithful emperor returned to his palace, and, as it was the time for the banquet, and his guests were assembled, he said that he could not partake of the entertainment, before the interdict was taken off. On this account he sent the most intimate of his suite to the bishop, beseeching him to order the imposer of the interdict to remove it. The bishop replied that an interdict ought not to be accepted from everyone, and pronounced it not binding, but the emperor refused to accept this remission until the imposer of it had after much difficulty been discovered, and had restored the communion withdrawn. So obedient was he to divine laws. In accordance with the same principles he ordered a complete destruction of the remains of the idolatrous shrines, that our posterity might be saved from the sight of even a trace of the ancient error, this being the motive which he expressed in the edict published on the subject. Of this good seed sown he is ever reaping the fruits, for he has the Lord of all on his side. So when Roilus, 1, prince of the Scythian nomads, had crossed the Danube with a vast host, and was ravaging and plundering Thrace, and was threatening to besiege the imperial city, and summarily seize it, and deliver it to destruction, God smote him from on high with thunderbolt and storm, burning up the invader, and destroying all his host. A similar providence was shown, too, in the Persian War. The Persians received information that the Romans were occupied elsewhere, and so in violation of the treaty of peace, marched against their neighbors, who found none to aid them under the attack, because, in a reliance on the peace, the emperor had dispatched his generals and his men to other wars. Then the further march of the Persians was staved by a very violent storm of rain and hail. Their horses refused to advance. In 20 days they had not succeeded in advancing as many furlongs. Meanwhile the generals returned and mustered their troops. In the former war, too, these same Persians, when besieging the emperor's eponymous city, too, were providentially rendered ridiculous. For after Vara reigns, 3, had beset the aforesaid city for more than 30 days, with all his forces, and had brought up many helepoles, and employed innumerable engines, and built up lofty towers outside the wall, resistance was offered, and the assault of the attacking engines repelled, by the bishop Oinomas alone. Our men had refused to fight against the foe, and were shrinking from bringing aid to the besieged, when the bishop, by opposing himself to them, preserved the city from being taken. When one of the barbarian chieftains ventured on his wonted blasphemy, and with words, like those of Rabshakeh and Sennacherib, madly threatened to burn the temple of God, the holy bishop could not endure his furious wrath, but himself commanded a ballista, 1, which went by the name of the Apostle Thomas, to be set up upon the battlements, and a mighty stone, to be adjusted to it. Then, in the name of the Lord who had been blasphemed, he gave the word to let go. Down crashed the stone on that impious chief, and hit him on his wicked mouth, and crushed in his face, and broke his head in pieces, and sprinkled his brains upon the ground. When the commander of the army, who had hoped to take the city, saw what was done, he confessed himself beaten, and withdrew, and in his alarm made peace. Thus the universal sovereign protects the faithful emperor, for he clearly acknowledges whose slave he is, and performs fitting service to his master, too. Chapter 37 of Theodotu, Bishop of Antioch. Theodosius restored the relics of the great luminary of the world to the city, which deeply regretted his loss. These events, however, happened later. 3. Innocent the excellent bishop of Rome was succeeded by Bonifacius, Bonifacius by Zosimus, and Zosimus by Calestinus, 1. At Jerusalem, after the admirable John, the charge of the church was committed to Paralius, a man worthy of his name, 2. At Antioch, after the divine Alexander Theodotuk, the pearl of purity, succeeded to the supremacy of the church, a man of conspicuous meekness and of exact regularity of life. By him the sect of Apollinarius was admitted to fellowship with the rest of the sheep on the earnest request of its members to be united with the flock. Many of them, however, continued marked by their former unsoundness. 3.